What Aaron and our other storytellers will be guiding us through next is what happened after they'd come down back to Earth after the transcendental happenings at the other Glastonbury in 1990, and how it set a new course for their lives in the free party scene and beyond.
Glastonbury 90 was the first time that dance music was really a part of the festival in both an official way. Adamski was on the Friday night and then the Happy Mondays played, and so there was a sense that dance music had gone a bit overground, but also dance music was looking for its rebellious home. A lot of rave sound systems turned up because it was the best opportunity to throw a kind of a illegal party with a huge crowd of people newly ready to embrace dance music outside.
This free party in the Glastonbury Travellers Field had lit a spark in Simon, who'd recently connected with their soon-to-be sound system crew, Spiral Tribe, back in London. Maybe they could do a party that wouldn't set ravers back the equivalent of 60 quid today to get in.
88, 89, you had the M25 raves where it was a kind of cash cow, I think. You know, although the spirit was there and dancing to this great music off their Nut on Ecstasy, it was like 20, 25s to get in.
Very quickly, all these big illegal raves had got kind of closed down by the police. 20,000 people in aircraft hangars around the M25 or in Blackburn in the warehouses or in Manchester. But then you've got a load of ravers who've just got a taste of this fabulous new combination. Music from outer space, the future for Chicago, Detroit, psychedelic experiences outside. And they're like, well, I don't want to let that go. That was the thing I've been after. The bit that was being legislated against was the fact that they were pay parties. So this, in a way, leaves a kind of a gap. Well, if pay parties are the problem, is there another thing, you know, and something else that can get around this idea?
That 1990 Glastonbury, that's a kind of important aspect in the story of how Spiral Tribe emerged a little bit.
I think so. It was inspirational to us, even though we hadn't all particularly come together as a unit. I don't know, it was just a magic moment in time where it's just that we can do this, you know, we can do this. We don't need to have all this infrastructure. You don't need to do it in a club. Do it yourself.
Before this story returns to the countryside, we first need to take it back along the M3 into London, where our future stewards of sound system culture will first cut their teeth in more familiar surroundings. Like Simon, Steve, who'd had his own filter-lifting moment in the Glastonbury Travellers Field, was now on a mission to start throwing his own pies in the abandoned warehouse spaces that he could see all around him in London in the end days of Thatcher's political reign in 1990.
So why did it blow up? I think it was just a perfect storm. Empty warehouses everywhere. The rave scene that had been going on had become more popular and started going into clubs, and people didn't want to go into clubs. A lot of the sound systems that were going on before, they were out of London. DIY was not in Circus Walk was West Country.
Steve then gets to work on his own Bedlam sound system. And in a squat across town, a few months on from Glastonbury, Spiral Tribe is born. Alongside Simon at its inception were Debbie and Mark.
Mark is like an amazing graphic artist, and he had coined the name Spiral Tribe because he was working in a photocopy shop and he magnified these spiral ammonite shells, and then it kind of just stuck. Somehow came together and was squatting in Westbourne Park. I borrowed a grand off my nan to buy the decks and a mixer and a mobile phone. Someone would call and go, oh, I found this really amazing empty warehouse. And we broke into the back of this building, and it was actually a club, like mirrored walls and a DJ booth and everything. It was like, whoa, that's on the vibe. This is meant to be.
And in almost no time at all, Bedlam and the Spirals were at the centre of a scene known for throwing some of London's best raves.
We were doing parties every single week. It was relentless. Do a party on a Saturday, pack up on a Monday, Tuesday we'd go out looking for another venue. Wednesday we would squat that venue. Friday we would move in. Saturday we'd do a party, and it went on like that.
And we encountered many different problems. Our rig got smashed up by the police. That happened once. But then people would come out of the woodwork. Suddenly someone would turn up. They would, oh, we've got some amp racks you can have. Technicians or artists or DJs, flyering, whatever we needed seemed to sort of manifest. I can't really explain it any other way than that. Magic. I mean, everyone sort of put some effort in, and that all came together on the dance floor. Everyone felt a part of it. I mean, that is the essence of a free party. You've given something and you're partaking, which makes the ambience and the vibe really special.
Everything that I was hearing sounded pretty close to the spirit of Stonehenge and the free festivals to me. A run of warehouse parties were under the belt of Spiral Tribe before we arrive at the summer of 91. It was time to leave the ceilings and walls behind and open the party out into the great outdoors.
We all went out to a free festival, and then we were like, what are we doing in London? We just need to, we should hit the road and join up with the next free festival. Literally a year later, we were rolling through the West Country with our rig on the back of an old newspaper van. And that's when we started to fuse directly with the travelling community.
Ixie, who'd had her mind blown by electronic music the previous summer, was living life as a horse-drawn traveller. And she would be absolutely sure to be in the right place at the right time when the free parties moved out to the country in the summer of 91.
Travelled up to Nottingham with the horses, and we had a party up there. Then we headed back down for the Chipping Sodbury Festival, and there was a sound system there. And I think that's the first festival when Debbie and Mark, they turned up. That's when we really connected with Spiral Tribe.
The joining of the travelling community and the rave community really made it bigger.
Suddenly there'd be maybe two parties in a weekend, maybe there'd be four parties in different locations with different crews.
Most of our parties that were outdoors were based around travelling community sites. There was a bit of a city vibe in there, then you had your horse-drawn, and then you had the locals that were there. And it was a real melange of people coming together on a bit of common land.
This growing number of sound systems got quicker and sharper at executing their plans to stay one step ahead of the law.
The amount of parties we've had where we've filled the space up before we turn the sound system, because we know that once we've done that, it moves the police to another level. If the police can get there before anyone's in there, they can shut it down really easy. Whereas if we've got 500 people in there, 1,000 people inside, they've got to go and get a brigade, and they're not going to do that. There was a strategic battle that we would play.
Everybody was getting on really, really well, from every walk of life, the ravers from the city, the travellers. We were all having fun and partying together. I think, in reality, ecstasy had a lot to do with it, because there was extremely good ecstasy going around. First years, when I lived on the road, there was a bit of a us and them sort of mentality, and that disappeared a bit. You know, most of the travellers were really into it, working together just to have good parties and good fun.
Real like crash course, I think, for me. I can't say I was hanging out with loads of travellers at Glastonbury, but a year later we were sharing the dance floor and egg butties. Yeah. And of course the hypnotic beats.
It just sounds like a kind of beautiful match made in heaven. Like, you have these DIY types, young, energetic, coming from their inner city scenes and then coming out, you know, big-hearted people anyway. They're about connectedness within the nature of their thing. And then they intersect with someone who's just superficially doing it a complete different way.
Yeah.
But it just catches fire.
Absolutely. It's alchemy, you know. It's like, put these two elements together, make something golden.
In this story, there was just so much to appreciate about the union and the chemistry of the free party movement. And there was no more essential component than the traveller's relationship to the land. The comparatively newer travellers, both in their vehicles and horse-drawn carts, were adopting ancient ways of living that was now enabling this new strand of the counterculture.
So there's a certain amount of knowledge that the travellers brought with them, understanding the bylaws, the liminal spaces between owned land. One of the famous ones on the Drove in Hampshire, in a place called Longstock. It was called the Rat's Run. This place, it's a green lane. And a green lane, you know, go back thousands of years, pre-industrial times. They were places that, you know, people would take their cattle. They were places people take their sheep to market and back. They were trodden on roads that had been there for, you know, maybe millennia, who knows. They weren't the Roman roads. These were the people's roads, you know. These were where traditional gypsies had parked up. These spaces were known to travellers because it was in their interest to find free spaces, of which obviously there's a dwindling number in kind of contemporary Britain. The free spaces then became a place that you could continue the Stonehenge concept, but with this music arriving. Increasingly, you know, the places that were hosting these parties were old MOD land, internment camps in the war. There's almost a kind of a sense of humour in kind of basing something that's sort of about gathering and, you know, enjoying each other's company in a place that's militarised.
And across these lesser-known spaces and portions of common land, the party people set out to make these parties for the people that would be supported by pocket change donations and a whole load of collective participation where anyone's efforts were welcome if it helped to sustain these blissed-out summers of rave.
You know, we didn't need the fairground rides, we didn't need the security, we didn't need the 5 million watt rig or whatever. What we had was enough. You know, we did pass a bucket round, literally. In fact, the horse-drawn girls, Ixie and Celia and Ness, you know, were really good at it. They would sort of dance around the crowd with a bucket and people bung their sort of change in. And there was always enough fuel money or something, or to buy a bit of pasta or something to feed us all. Or we always had enough to get somewhere somehow. You know, it was a communal pot. There was no wages. It worked. There was always enough.
And you were living a life that was rich in meaning rather than...
Yeah. I mean, it's that thing of being part of something that was sort of greater than us. You know, I knew that's where I had to be.
Children will dance. And on this non-stop summer tour, there was one event for Simone that remains clear in the memory amongst all the haze.
That first summer, 91, it was the White Goddess Festival in Cornwall. Our truck had broken down. We got a hire lorry, curtain-sided lorry that we put the rig on. And it was this vast, vast moor. So at night, you literally felt you're on top of a planet. The moon up there just went on and on and on. And actually, the festival went on and on for 2 weeks. And the music didn't stop. Carried along on this sort of wave of the future and dancing and feeling at one with each other, and it was magical. And then I remember we left there finally, and we stopped off at someone's parents' house. And one put the TV on, and I just remember laughing hysterically it was like a culture, you know, massive culture shock. It's like, what the fuck is, someone stuck the telly on, it was like the news, and it just, was just like, what? It was like, you know, felt like you're tripping. Sort of, yeah. After this sort of 2 weeks of being on the top of the planet, you know.
Good morning from Andrew Mitt, 7 o'clock, the headlines.
The feeling the whole free party whirlwind left with Simone when there was a moment to catch her breath is a profound one for any young person to feel.
Just that freedom, expression, supportive, everyone looked out for each other, belonging to something. Memories that I felt really, finally, like I'd found my family. I'd found my tribe. Words I don't think, as birds fly by.